Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm Joe Devine and I'm joined now by Alex Stewart.
Hello, Joe.
Seb Stafford-Blore.
Morning, Joe.
Morning. Game relevant still today. We will be discussing things that have come from games that are relevant to the time now. The games include such games as Manchester United, West Ham. I believe that was the order. I think it was. I don't know where they were. And also Everton versus... Blanking.
Tottenham.
The Totters. The Spurs. We talk all about the Totters and the Spurs and the Evertons, and we talk about Manchester United and West Ham. Specifically, Donny van der Beek. We talk about Richarlison. We talk about subs being subbed. We talk about my fear of chewing gum. We talk about Leicester. Actually, we don't talk about Leicester, but we promise to talk about Leicester next time. And we revisit the stats and facts database, which is a very exciting time for all of us. But before we get started, let me remind you that if you enjoy football and if you want to have something to fill your life with, then you should find The Athletic at a 7-day free trial. If you visit theathletic.com/tifo, you can get that 7-day free trial and you could use it to read, for example, Jack Pitbrook talking about Mourinho's Spurs. Also, he did it with Mark Carey, who's one of the new data writers who works here. And they did an interesting comparison of Mourinho to Pochettino's last few years. It was really useful for me in my research for what turned out to be not for this podcast, because we ended up not really talking about it. But also there's Paddy Boyland, who I'm sure will have written something about Richarlison before. David Ornstein, whose column I read every Monday and get excited about things that are happening in the news. And generally just a host of excellent journalists who are all doing good things, aren't they, Seb?
They sure are. I've been enjoying Joe Durso's work as well. He's been doing very interesting things on gambling sponsors in the Premier League.
Dr. Durso. Yeah, always worth a read, is old Dursey. Alex, what have you enjoyed reading recently?
Michael Cox's piece on Peniel Harder in the WSL and how she's now arguably the best female player in the world. Very, very good piece.
Yeah, nice. Okay. Well, listen. Basically, everything's happening there. It's like, you know, when you live in a small town and the circus is in town, and even if you don't like circuses, you kind of have to go because it's the circus and you live in a small town. It's like that, yeah? Maybe you don't want to go, but allow the social pressure of me repeating this over and over again to seep into your bones and pick up your phone and just type in theathletic.com/tifo and think, I'm doing a good thing. I'm doing a good thing. And then just see what it's like for free for 7 days. And if you don't like it, then just delete it and don't pay for it. And that's okay, because it's all just about the product, baby. Yeah? Was that good?
That was very nice.
Thanks. Okay. Well, in which case, I'll leave you in the warm hands and the cool embrace of Seb Stafford-Blore and Alex Stewart. Okay, let's begin with Everton-Tottenham, game relevant. We're going to talk about Richarlison today, but first, of course, let's reference the context. 5-4, huh? Alex, this was a game with 9 goals, and it didn't include Southampton.
Oh, wow.
I mean, that's... Yeah.
It's just a bad joke,
cheers,
isn't it?
For that. Well, yeah, but it's yeah, okay.
Listen, the reason I bring this up, not the 9 goals thing, the reason I want to talk about Richarlison is, and I'm going to sound a little pompous now, a little bit, territorial, but I would like both of you to confirm that I said in the text chat, let's talk about Richarlison before he scored a goal, okay? Before he turned his performance into, you know, potentially a game-winning one. I was on the money, wasn't I, Seb?
Yeah, you were. I mean, also, after he scored his first goal, you did spend another kind of 5 minutes talking about how prescient you were and how you were, quote, sure, football. It was weird. You had a kind of funny turn.
I'm the best at football.
Yeah, that's a direct quote from the WhatsApp group.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. And it stands to this day. Listen, the reason I thought this, right, wasn't because of his goals. It was because we don't talk about Richarlison very much at the moment. And that's for obvious reasons. James Rodriguez is in the same team, as is Dominic Calvert-Lewin. And, you know, both of them... I think Everton have moved from a team where Richarlison was perhaps the most exciting player to a team where Richarlison is one of the most exciting players, and so it's natural that he's not the forefront of the conversation anymore. But to me, as a sort of bystander, someone who did not watch Everton every game, and someone who, you know, allowed his Everton opinion to be formed by what other people said, I thought of Richarlison a couple of seasons ago that he was ready to pop off. You know, he was ready to pop off big time. That there were the same sorts of, you know, distant rumours that you would hear about Adama Traore joining Barcelona as there were for Richarlison. He felt very much like a player at his age. I suppose at the time, 2 seasons ago, he was only 21. You weren't really sure where his ceiling was, and I'm not sure that we are still. Now, he's done very, very well, and obviously Everton hugely missed him when he had his period of injury layoff. But he hasn't popped off, has he, Seb?
He hasn't, but I feel like there are a few mitigating factors around that. He's had a career which has been blighted by external circumstances. So obviously his time at Watford ended with Marcus Silva getting sacked and Javi Gracia replacing him. And then his move to Everton was successful for him. If you look at what surrounded him during that time, succession of different managers, some stability now with Carlo Ancelotti, of course. But he's been managed by Silva again, by David Unsworth, by Sam Allardyce. And also there's kind of been a little bit of a rotating cast around him. So he's played with Cenk Tosun at different points. Theo Walcott has been alongside him in that forward line. Gylfi Sigurdsson has been in the 10, now replaced by kind of James Rodriguez. Alex Iwobi's in there. So there's a lot of flux, and that's difficult for a player. And hopefully the ways in which a career grows is when it has the kind of stability to do that. So that's kind of, you need that external stabilized context really to judge him properly and for him to progress forward, I think.
Alex, what kind of player is he? Because it seems to me, you know, 23 years old, as I said before, we're not really entirely sure what his ceiling is. It feels like he could improve dramatically still.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think it's a good question, because if you look at what type of player he is in terms of his statistics, he's sort of caught between being a good forward and a good wide attacking midfielder, inverted winger type of player. So he's like a forward who maybe doesn't score quite so much, but adds a lot in terms of carries and dribbles and pressing particularly. Or if he's a winger, he does that well, but he doesn't assist quite as much as you'd expect. And I think that's partly a result of how he's used at Everton. So last season, quite a lot of the time, he was used effectively as a second striker off Calvert-Lewin in a 4-4-2. This season, although he plays wide on the left, his job is very much to sit in that channel, to receive long passes, carry it towards goal. And, you know, he's not particularly definitively one thing or another. And I think maybe with a player like him, you kind of want to nail down exactly what that best position is if you're going to look at him as being somebody who's producing goals, assists, that kind of thing at the level of a top player. But I think what he does for Everton is extremely useful in their system and works very well currently.
I mean, when we look at Everton's system as well and the players that are currently performing within it, the left forward role is pretty much the only role Richarlison's going to get to play, right? I mean, James Rodriguez playing on that right-hand side, as you know in a video, I don't think it will have gone out when people are listening to this, Alex, but it's a minor note in the video, so it's probably worth and interesting enough to talk about now. James Rodriguez plays obviously on the right forward role a lot of the time, but he still has the function of a creative 10, right? Dominic Calvert-Lewin, obviously at the 9, is turning into one of the best strikers in the Premier League, and he's genuinely exciting prospect still, even at his level. You feel like with those two players accommodating defenders, Richarlison should be having a better run of it this season than he otherwise would have done.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. And it's the way you've described it is this sort of lopsided effect where although Richarlison and James are effectively starting in the same positions out wide, James is dropping off and tucking inside and Richarlison is pushing up and tucking inside the other way, and it creates almost a kind of 1-2 shape. But because Richarlison has this pace and ball carrying ability, a lot of the time what he's looking to do is drive forwards at an angle with then Calvert-Lewin kind of creating space for him. And it is quite a dynamic role. It's like a he plays as a striker, but he starts wider than you'd expect. And previously, when we've seen strikers in wide positions, it's been people like, I don't know, Mandzukic, who is used as like a wide target man. You know, you kind of lump the ball over to him and he's nodding it in. Richarlison's sort of, it's a slightly different role. I think he's going to develop into it. You know, I think this is an Everton team that are improving under Ancelotti. But the balance of that front three is very, very important. And you kind of worry if there's a disruption to it. Like Seb says, if, you know, if he goes back to having to work out how to play with different players, that might affect how he's performing this season.
Yeah. And Seb, just a word on Gylfi Sigurdsson as well, because he's a player who's found it difficult to get into the team this season. The natural formation doesn't quite suit his style of play. But he played last night, he scored a penalty and he assisted three. And particularly his assist for Bernard was just superb, right? He had a fantastic game.
Yeah, that assist for Bernard was brilliant. Sort of the quick processing of the game around him and the timing of the ball was just a lovely little bit of football. And the problem with Sigurdsson has always been that if you watch him and if you watch him compared to someone like, well, James would be the best example, his first touch isn't quite as reliable and isn't quite as slick as it needs to be to exist at the very top of the game. And yet, given the opportunity, he's capable of doing brilliant things with the ball at his feet. To me, he's like a slightly out of tune instrument in an orchestra, isn't he? Like, he has his merits and, you know, he has value, but he doesn't quite fit the picture of what's going on around him. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. And also, I suppose, you know, last night, Everton played a 4-2-3-1. And he sat in that 10 role, and that's where he's best. And the vast majority of games this season, they've played a 4-3-3. And he just doesn't have a natural place in that system. It's a shame, really.
Well, also, you know, as Alex said, and, you know, as the video will make clear, like, part of the facility in this formation is for James to drop inside a little bit and sort of act as a pseudo quasi 10. God, that is horrible. What a terrible kind of Brendan Rodgersism that is.
the pseudo 10.
Oh, that's Alex. That should have. How is it that I've said that and not you? That's ridiculous.
Yeah, really. Rubbing off.
So as a result, like if you've got Rodriguez drifting into that position, then what do you do with someone like Sigurdsson? You can't accommodate both, and you can't get the best out of both in the same system. And obviously, Rodriguez wins that battle. Unfortunately, it's a shame for him. I just think he's one of those players. If you look back at his career, he's been in the wrong place at the wrong time consistently. He could have been a very good Spurs player, but wrong era for him. He could have been an excellent Everton player, kind of the wrong era for him. And he was excellent at Swansea for long periods of time, but it was during a period when they were really struggling and when there were very few pieces around him.
Well, you know what? He's been a valuable asset to the Icelandic international team. So hopefully that satiates his need for consistency and quality when he retires. Hey, you know how we like to think about players as they retire and hoping that they feel happy.
I'm still reeling from quasi-pseudo 10. I just sure. I can't believe I said that publicly.
Before we move on from Everton, I want to understand from Alex's perspective, from your perspective, Alex, this team generally, they haven't come up a huge amount since the beginning of the season. We talked about them a lot then because they were very exciting. They won four or five games on the trot right off the bat. Carlo Ancelotti is the coach. James Rodriguez is this iconic player. I mean, they feel like they've got a real good thing going. Presumably they can, you know, keep this team together next season. Do you feel that there might be more consistency?
You would hope so. I mean, I suppose the tricky thing always with assessing a team like Everton is the movement of teams around them. So you've got a fairly well-established, you know, top five or six, which I think, you know, this season we can say Leicester City has joined rather than Arsenal. But with teams like West Ham, Villa, Leeds, you know, there's a lot in that mix that I think Everton previously had that kind of seventh, eighth position pretty much sewn up, and there's a lot of competition for it now. So you're judging it in absolute terms, in terms of how Everton themselves are progressing, which I think is well, and they've got some good players, and it's nice to see people like Mason Holgate getting minutes as well. But then are they slightly treading water compared to some of these other sides around them? Let me say this to you,
okay? Everton, they actually have a couple of games in hand on most of the teams in the league, right? Currently 21 games played, 37 points. Liverpool, 23 games played, 40 points. If Everton win both of their games in hand, they're even with Leicester in third. I mean, maybe I'm wrong to say inconsistency.
Well, I think the thing is that, again, it's a sort of heuristic in terms of how we look at these teams, because there's a level of play and quality that you sometimes see exhibited from those other teams that I'm not convinced you see consistently from Everton. I think they still have, obviously, now Robin Olsen has replaced Jordan Pickford, and whether that will persist after Pickford's return, I'm not sure. I think he was on the bench yesterday. But, you know, they have problems they need to sort out in terms of building that balance, retaining the midfield solidity that they exhibited at the beginning of the season. So you can certainly see them moving in the right direction, but I'm also not convinced that it's quite sustainable at that level yet.
Seb, though, if you're an Everton fan at this point in the season, you're thinking you can finish top four. You've got an opportunity to finish top four.
I think so. I'm thinking also I need to keep a couple of these players fit. I'd be very worried. I mean, obviously, we are recording the day after the Everton-Spurs game and Dominic Calvert-Lewin limped off, which would be pretty concerning to me. Decore is very important. Rodriguez, obviously, very, very important. Michael Keane has become really important. I think like one of the understated parts of their season has been the kind of reclamation of his reputation. Like, he was a little bit of a joke a couple of years ago. He was a sort of, he's had, you know, a chance with the England side because of a large transfer fee and a Manchester United background. But in reality, he's become one of the more stable defenders in the country.
I think it's a very interesting point, that, because I've noticed, particularly over the last sort of month or so, Michael Keane and also Declan Rice are two players who I think have excelled recently. But when I recall them playing for England, I remember mistakes. I remember things being very static, very slow. And they seem like really, really different players playing for their club sides than they do for their national team. And I wonder sometimes whether that those England performances overshadow how we view those players unless we actually sit and watch them for a period.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I wonder whether I'm ever able to judge England players fairly when they play for England, just because I have so much built up resentment over the years and so many kind of assumptions about why players are being picked and what the secret agenda is.
That's a fair point. Not that Seb hates England, although obviously
he hates England. He's not a patriot. Listeners,
moved. He wants away.
He wants to burn his own country to the ground. Yeah, but what about the flag, Seb? The flag.
Jack Grealish came in. One of the interesting things about that, obviously, Grealish performed really well in those games, but the backdrop was almost like Southgate doesn't really want to select him and doesn't really want to use him and kind of doesn't have an option. And I wonder if there was a greater degree of positivity towards him almost because of that slight tension. Whereas players that seem to glide into the England team, yeah, maybe you think, well, do they deserve that?
Before you answer that question, Seb, let me ask you this. Did you read the Guardian special investigation about the Queen?
No, I did not.
You didn't read that?
No, are you going to accuse me of...
I'm just wondering if it's because you're not a patriot, I don't know.
I'm going to gloss over this and just respond to Alex's question and just say that...
Thank you, Seb.
The problem for Gareth Southgate is this historic issue? And like, when something like Grealish comes along, we're not judging him on the way that he's managed the team over the last few years. We're judging him on things that, I don't know, Sven-Goran Eriksson did. And now, when you see a Grealish-like case where there's a little bit of a hesitation over a flair player or someone from outside the kind of the top six, then all of this corked frustration comes pouring out from everyone.
But I think
it's been built up over decades.
I think Southgate did play into that, not deliberately, I'm sure, but he was hardly effusive in his praise of Grealish, despite the fact he was clearly the best player in the games that he played. Like there seemed to be almost a reticence to
listen,
really
guys. I've got the answer here.
Is it to do with the Queen?
And
there's
the Guardian.
An anti Aston Villa prejudice in the England team. I know that for a fact because you know who told me?
Tyrone Mings.
The Queen told me.
Ah, okay.
She said specifically, I quote, I don't quote, obviously, England managers have always hated Aston Villa players, and they will never praise them even if they're forced to pick them.
Tyrone Mings is actually from Bath. He is the first Bath-born footballer to represent England since some guy in the 1800s who I've forgotten. I feel like
really
we should have like a postbox, a gold
postbox. In over 100 years.
Or, you know, something like that, yeah. So there aren't that many Bath-born professional footballers. Ashley Barnes is really the only one. And
when you
somehow
say Bath
he's also
born,
Austrian.
I feel like we should clarify that Bath is a place. That doesn't mean like children that are born
in a water birth.
Bath is a quaint little town
it's not a town, it's a city. We've got
well,
a cathedral.
You know.
No, sure. No.
Sure.
Yeah. These are the rules. Uh-huh. Cathedral equals city.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a quaint little town in the west of England, and you know, it's fine. Basically,
it's a thriving.
I'm sure if you wanted to buy a wooden clock, you know, you could probably do it there. That's the sort of place you'd be able to buy a little wooden clock. Yeah,
Winchester's got Wayne Bridge. He was born.
Hey, that's nice. That's nice. Quite a few England caps there. Good.
Yeah. And apparently a guy called Bob Anderson, who was a former BDO World Darts champion.
We are going to talk about Spurs, but not today. We're going to talk about them on Monday because they have a big game at the weekend. Suffice to say, I've written a little note here about Spurs that I wanted to read. And I've written, compare them to being in a deep into a long-term relationship and losing all perspective. I don't know what normal is. Where is the anchor? What do I compare this to? Do other couples do this? That's what I've written down. Because I remember talking about Spurs 3 months ago and thinking like, maybe Mourinho's a genius. Like, maybe actually, you know, maybe there is an anti-Mourinho thing. And now I think, what the fuck was I talking about? Like, they're dog shit. And then I'm sure on Monday when they, you know, have beaten Man City the weekend, I'll think, I don't know what's happening. I'm being gaslit. I'm confused. I you know.
This is a this season problem in extremis, though, isn't it? Because
I think when teams
do well and then do badly, we were talking about this on the text last night as well, and my exhaustion with everything is stuff flips backwards and forwards between being the best and the worst, and then you add Mourinho into that, who is such a divisive manager anyway, then you get an even more extreme version of, you know, because it's basically oscillating between all of you Mourinho haters are idiots, he's the best coach ever, you know, he's still got it, and then no, Mourinho's actually just terrible.
I think even on a more kind of basic level than that, I don't even know if he's competent anymore. I can't work out. I feel like I look at the results. I think, okay. Oh, no. We're going to have this conversation on Monday. I'm getting drawn into it. Before we move on from Everton, right, one more thing. You mentioned Mason Holgate, Alex, there, as a player who it's good to see. Yeah, it's good to see some minutes from. Hey, I wholeheartedly agree. You know what's not good to see, Alex?
Tell me, Joe.
Gum chewing. Whilst playing football. And hey, don't get me wrong, this is not some kind of moral offence, right? I'm not talking about it from the... I'm not inside a church, yeah? I'm not saying this offends God. I'm saying this makes me want to choke when I see it. When I see professional football players running around on a football pitch, breathing deeply through their mouths often, and they're chewing gum... I actually get the like psychosomatic throat closing up feeling, which is the same reason I couldn't take painkillers in pill form until I was like 25 years old. I think I had the cord wrapped around my neck when I was born. That's what mother said. Mother's always said maybe that's who I am, you know? But I choke up when I see it. It makes me want to gag. And
hey,
I just
Alex.
Wondered if this has an effect on anyone else.
Alex, I told you this would make a great pod bit. Like you just dangle this for someone like Joe, and he just plunges headlong into the big.
It's a physical reaction to something that can cause me no harm. You know,
I mean,
I basically don't like gum anyway because I'm afraid of choking. But
that's not why I don't like it.
Oh, go on.
Well, I don't like it because I've got that classic kind of spectrum thing of being unable to deal with noises.
Yes, mouth noises,
mouth noises particularly, other noises also. So
you could never live with a cow, could you? Or a camel.
If someone's making a particular, like I get fixated on that noise. So yeah. Last night, for example, I dipped into the commentary for the Spurs-Everton game a little bit, and Glenn Hoddle kept sniffing. And after about...
I think he was eating nuts as well.
After about a minute, I had to turn it back off again because I was literally going insane. I just can't... And gum chewing produces that same effect for me. It's just repugnant.
So it gets you in a different way. What about you, Seb?
I don't have the same reaction to either of you, but I don't like it. For instance, I deeply, deeply, deeply hope that Brentford don't get promoted to the Premier League purely because of the way Thomas Frank chew's gone. I hate it. I feel like if his mother or father watches Brentford games and sees that, I would think they probably call him at full time and say, stop that immediately. Just stop it.
Alex Ferguson used to do this too, didn't he? He would like sometimes turn the gum over outside of his mouth. You know, it would pop out of the lip.
He didn't chew with his mouth open as much, and it's just like it's so.
Yeah, he had a small mouth. I don't know.
It feels a bit performative. I mean,
well, anyway, it really upsets me. And to any footballers listening, please don't do it because you're making me choke in my own home. Donny van der Beek. Let's talk about Donny van der Beek after the break.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Right, that was a break, and now we're going to talk about Donny van der Beek. I'm just reading my notes here, Seb, and you'll know, interestingly, that there's a lot of football on at the moment, don't you?
I do, yes, I'm aware.
Every night. I think Alex and I were talking about this yesterday. And of course, that puts a lot of strain on a home life, domestic scenarios. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, because actually, a couple of nights ago, you can just flow into different games. So I watched all of the FA Cup games on Tuesday, and then purely on the basis that I couldn't quite be bothered to go to bed and leave the sofa, I found myself watching Gil Vicente against Sporting Club in a monsoon. And I looked at the clock at about 10:45 and just thought, what the fuck am I doing? And just went to bed. It's like that's life now, isn't it? You live.
I hadn't expected to feel so depressed when I started this segment, but that's okay. I'll roll with it. Alex knows what I'm talking about. Anyway, the reason I bring this up is because obviously I live at home with a partner, and we like to spend time together, as is our want. You know, we've decided to do that, so it's nice if we actually have the time to do that. But there's a lot of football, and because you know, there's a fiendish gang of teepos who deserve our respect, and this means I have to watch the football regularly. So trying to find little moments to spend time together. This resulted in Megan taking all of my notes for me, like a good assistant. After the Manchester United West Ham game, subsequently my diary has one page of exceptionally nice and neat handwriting versus my,
scrawl.
Yeah, my scrawl. Anyway, it is very neat, but it's of a kind of script that is actually I'm struggling to read it. So I'm trying to say van der Beek. I told her to write down van der Beek, tough game. Poor performance, she wrote. It looks a lot like nobody wants to pass him the ball, which is where I will start, because Alex and I talked about this a lot during the game. It looks a lot like nobody wants to pass him the ball. Alex, you looked at the numbers, and the numbers say, I am a fucking idiot.
This is a really, really interesting point, isn't it? Because what your eye was telling you and what my eye was telling me were the same. But if you actually look at the numbers, Donny van de Beek is having the ball passed to him quite a lot. He's just not receiving it very often. And I think there's a reason for this, and it's the type of player that van de Beek is very different from the type of player that Bruno Fernandes is. So Fernandes is looking to drop off to receive the ball in space, play it forwards, and then maybe make a run into the box, whereas van de Beek plays much, much higher up in this United team. He's looking to play almost against defenders. He's very, very technically capable. If you watch some of the best things that he did for Ajax, you know, his dribbling is amazing. His close control under pressure is really, really strong. And so he's confident in the way that he wants to play the game, but United's passers aren't giving him the ball in that way.
It's been difficult for him, right? He doesn't have many opportunities to play. There's certainly a narrative around that now. It's clear to everybody that Manchester United spent X amount of million pounds on him, and he's, you know, sat on the bench for the vast majority of the season. And so when he does get opportunities, you know, it's that kind of double-edged sword, as the commentary team pointed out on the night, that you really need a run of games to grow into any kind of form, particularly if there's a confidence issue that could potentially be, you know, related to the situation that he's currently in. But also when you're coming into a team to replace a player that is not just as good as Bruno Fernandes, but as important to the team, that is so difficult. That's such a bad situation to be in. And you want to see players, you know, rise to meet those sort of scenarios. Donny van de Beek spent, I feel like, half of his time in deep, wide positions where a combination of Matic, Fred, and, as you know, Tellers maybe, or Rashford, would just pass the ball around him. And he seemed to be moving into areas where they didn't need the extra man in that place. You know, it's a bit like when you watch Thiago directing the defenders and the wide players to pass the ball. It never actually comes to him, but it goes around him and he's in charge of it. Because, you know, the pass directly across is quicker than the pass to him. Donny van de Beek seems to often find himself in those positions, which is odd to me. And the other place he seems to find himself regularly, you know, the complete counter-extreme, is literally on the line with the striker, looking to run in behind, looking to, you know, request that Nemanja Matic play a 30-yard over-the-top ball, which I don't think is ever going to happen. I understand and respect that to a certain extent. You have to learn and grow into playing with your teammates. He hasn't had a lot of time to do so, and I certainly wouldn't put Matic's passing ability, lack of or not, down to Donny van de Beek. But there just seems to be such a chasm between those two default positions. It's like I play the game Rocket League on PlayStation 4, right? And one of the things that people talk about as you go up the ranks is a player is very likely to default to goal when they lose the ball. And that is not always the best thing to do. And I feel like watching Donny van de Beek, he has a kind of default option, and it might not always be the best thing to do. Or maybe I'm just looking at him in the chasm, the absence of Bruno Fernandes. What do you think?
No, I think that's quite fair, because Fernandes is kind of a moments player. For all of his tactical importance and his, you know, very consistent influence, his Manchester United career has essentially been a series of anecdotes. You know, remember when he played that pass, that goal, that touch, you know, these kind of things. Van de Beek isn't really suited to playing like that. And what you see when he plays for Man United is someone who has been tasked with doing their very, very best Bruno Fernandes impression. And, you know, him not really having the abilities to do it. So he takes up a lot of the positions that Bruno would. He mimics a lot of the traits. So you talked about him going up to the defensive line and trying to go beyond it and trying to receive passes. Very Bruno-like quality. And then the kind of the orchestrating, you know, the dynamic that he has. Again, it's when he was at Ajax, he always struck me as someone that was like not a system player in a bad way, but just someone that was an extension of more aggressive players around him. And he profited from that. So he would find himself in attacking positions almost as an extension of other players' work. So if you think back to the semi-final against Spurs, the first leg, when he scored that goal at White Hart Lane, that felt like just a natural place for him to be, rather than an instruction that he'd taken onto the field and used to exploit defensive weakness. He felt like a more organic type. The Man United player, the Man United version of Donny van de Beek, sort of it moves between someone who's trying a little bit too hard, someone who is way out of their comfort zone, trying to do things that they're not naturally suited to doing. And also, like you say, trying to fill a shadow of a player that he doesn't really bear much relation to.
I would add to that as well and say not by fault of his own. Term, what I'm about to say rather than what you just said. Okay. But this kind of term can be applied to players, you know, pejoratively, and that's not what I'm doing. But the result of everything that you've just said and the result of what I said before, what that actually leaves with him on the pitch is a passenger sometimes. And you can't be a passenger in a Manchester United team. You can't be a passenger in a Premier League team. I feel like too often he's in a position where he's either unused. My wonder before was whether the other players didn't want to pass him the ball, because that's really what it seemed like. But maybe the reality is he's just in the wrong place, or as you said, he's trying too hard to get onto the ball, trying too hard to make things happen. He only has a short window of opportunity to impress the manager and impress the fans, and that's a huge amount of pressure.
I think when you're in his situation, when you've moved to a club for a very large fee and you've been a little bit marginalised and you're only given opportunities to impress in short bursts of minutes or in deprioritised games, there's an expectation of a conclusive moment. People are searching for that, aren't they? The people that have advocated for his involvement in the first team at United are waiting for quote unquote the definitive proof that they are right. And that's, in football terms, it doesn't really exist, but it would be, you know, the 30-yard goal, the raking 40, 50-yard pass. And these things aren't really in Van der Beek's locker. And so he's caught in this weird situation where he's trying to provide evidence of his, I don't know, suitability. It's just a very strange place for a football player to be.
I disagree with some of this, because I think if you watch Van der Beek at Ajax, those things absolutely are in his locker. The problem is that, so at Ajax, he played either as a sort of second striker, where getting up onto the line and using that close control, taking those quick, short passes, the sort of player who would have worked really, really well in sort of mid-era Pochettino Spurs. He's that kind of player. But also as a central midfielder at Ajax, either playing in a double pivot but with a central defender who would step up into that, or in a midfield three, he would sit off, he would play those long passes into the channels, and then he would be breaking forwards. And I think the problem that he has at United is that the central midfield role at United isn't that at the moment, although arguably it could be and he could play in that. But also the 10 role isn't that, because Fernandes sits back and finds pockets of space to orchestrate play a lot more than Van der Beek, who wants to push up, who wants to be a technical, aggressive, kind of shadow striker type of a 10, rather than a metronomic pass the ball around and then move himself kind of number 10. Like, he's just... United don't... I agree that he's not playing well for United, but I don't think that's because he's not got certain of those qualities in his game. It's because the way United are constructed doesn't suit him at this point in time.
Do you not see some of those traits in Fernandes' game, though? Because obviously part of his role is to be deeper, yes, but a lot of his game is also to be aggressive, and that should suit Van der Beek. It's a different
kind of aggression, though. I think Fernandes is making those runs. So Van der Beek can make those runs if he starts as a central midfielder, and Bruno makes those runs from an attacking midfield position. But Bruno's runs are later than Van der Beek is. He's sort of, Fernandes is in the middle of the two types of runs that Van der Beek wants to make, and I think that's where the problem is. I agree that Fernandes is an aggressive player. I agree that he plays forwards, but he doesn't start receiving the ball in that advanced position up against a defensive line. He receives it deeper and then makes his run forwards.
But that's what I mean, though, because Van der Beek was comfortable receiving the ball in deeper positions at Ajax. Admittedly, he had a player like De Jong there as well, and that kind of eases the burden, and it kind of all the kind of the avenues out of defence went through him for a period. Except that, but there seems to be a kind of like, there seems to be a situation where United won't put him into either of those categories. They just want him to mimic what Fernandes does on the pitch, and that's really strange to me. Like,
yeah,
because
that I agree with.
Okay,
I think the point where I disagree is that it's not working because he doesn't have the capabilities of doing that. I think where his lack of ability is showing is in terms of how he adapts. I think that the way he wants to play the game isn't gelling with the way Manchester United want to use him at the moment. And so his failure is a tactical one. It's not a technical one.
Do you think maybe there's a personality issue here? Because I don't know very much about Donny van de Beek as a man, but Fernandes as a personality, like, it's pretty vivid that, you know, he's a kind of, I don't want to, you know, use something as try as leader, but there is a kind of an aggressive Man United-ish.
Captain leader legend.
Yeah.
I wasn't going to go there, but kind of, yeah. I mean, he's spiky, isn't he?
We said this in the chat, didn't we? We said he's the most captain-y non-captain.
Yeah, exactly.
We said Maguire is kidding himself. Clearly, Fernandes
that. That I thought was unfair.
You said that.
Because Maguire does have those characteristics, but if you look at the difference between someone
he's
like Van de Beek and Fernandes,
isn't he? Yeah.
Yeah, like it's there is a big contrast between the two people. And I wonder I can't quantify how effective that is.
Okay. This is interesting, and you're both good people with legitimate and valid views. But it's not that I'm bored of it. It's that the listeners... No, it's that we've got to move on because we've only got technically 1 minute left, and there's a couple of other things we've got to talk about. Let's rush over these briefly and tell you what. We were going to talk about Leicester ahead of their game, but we're not going to have time to do that today, even though we want this second show to be forward-facing. So we promise to talk about Leicester's performance in that game on Tuesday's podcast. So listen out for that, Leicester fans. Next up, David Moyes was at Old Trafford for this game because he is the manager of West Ham, and that's how that works. Apparently it was the 14th time since he'd been there. Hasn't won yet. Since he lost the job, I mean, and he looked unhappy. But that's just David Moyes for you. Two things happened with David Moyes in this game, which struck me as odd. I'm not sure I've seen before combined. Two substitutes were substituted, which is a thing. I don't know if I've ever seen that. Now, Odubeko was one of them, the 18-year-old forward who I believe had been part of Manchester United's academy in the past. There was another player as well, and I'm looking through my notes to see if I can find who it was. It was Diop, first half. Yeah, Issa Diop came on the first half and then was substituted in the second half. It's a kind of odd thing. It struck me that this is an FA Cup game, right? That you're allowed five subs. Is that if it goes to extra time, or are you just allowed five subs anyway?
West Ham also made the first concussion sub in the history of English football. During that
Did
game.
They? Well, so, that's very yeah, interesting, so but does that answer my question, Seb?
No, but it's part of the substitution. You're allowed to make one extra anyway. So in FA Cup game at the moment, you are allowed to make five, but you could make six
you
if
could
one
make
of them
six.
Was a concussion. So, or,
how
I
many
suppose,
did,
infinite.
Did they make? So you can make five at any point in the game. You know, it's not an extra time related thing.
You get one extra in extra time, but I think like the League Cup and like some European football competitions, you're allowed to make five substitutions in those games.
Can,
not in the
can I say, Seb, you're talking around this like you're writing a GCSE essay and you don't really know the answer.
I've got to three words a line towards the end of my answer sheet.
I mean, you're really filling this with quite a lot of fluff and I'm not really clear. Just one more time. Just normal, not including the...
you're allowed to make five substitutions.
Okay, thanks, man. That's good to know. Why are you making it so complicated?
Just had a lot to question. Say. I wanted to fit it all in. And
no,
you
thanks.
Cut me off and call me boring
exactly.
If I don't do it quickly.
Is, this is what happens, isn't it? This is the result of people who've spent a long time with dominant personality. Okay. Anyway, the reason I was bringing this up is because it's weird. Can't remember a time ever that I've seen that happen twice before. Obviously, the context is different with the number of substitutes, and maybe that's the main point here. Injuries as well, of course, too. It felt a little bit sad for young Odubeko because he's only 18 years old, and he came on, you know, in the second half. He came on ahead of Benrahma, Was it Ben Rama? It was, I think,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
I think it was Ben Rama. The commentators thought we were going to come. No, it wasn't Ben Rama. It was Adubeko. And that was an exciting. Oh, can I see a young 18-year-old player? It's always it's exciting to see a young 18-year-old footballer, isn't it? And then his little face when he got taken off. It was just sad. I mean, I know, I'm sure there were tactical reasons for it. And I'm sure, you know, listen, he basically didn't have a touch of the ball. But it's difficult, isn't it? It reminded me of Ralf Hasenhüttl saying in that most recent of the 9-0 defeats that he stopped making substitutes because he didn't want that to be the debut for some of those players. But 18, subbed on, subbed off. Alex, what do you think?
Well, I think it's tricky because he did play an hour. I mean, it's not, you know, because he was brought on and then played through most of extra time. So, yeah, from a psychological point of view, it's not ideal to be taken off, but it's not like he was only on the pitch for, you know, 30 minutes like Diop, which, to be fair, was a tactical substitution because Moyes then went to a back three and rejigged everything around. But also, he didn't really do anything. So,
no,
you know, and at that point, they were chasing the game. I mean, I think Moyes maybe, I think perhaps bringing him on in the first place was a bit odd. But, you know, otherwise, you've got to look at that and say that when Moyes brought on Johnson and Fredericks, they were excellent substitutions that brought West Ham back into the game. So I don't think you can necessarily criticise all his decisions in that.
I think the stigma of it is worse than the reality. I think it makes sense. Like Alex has said, he didn't do anything. And so from a tactical qualifier for the next round point of view, is it such a bad thing if he's not playing well? I understand it's harsh and I understand that it'd be, you know, pretty uncomfortable coach ride back to London, but sometimes it happens. Happened to Leroy Sané in December. Hansi Flick took him off after, like, I think he was only on the pitch for about 36 minutes. Happened to Hossam Ghali at Spurs, and it was against Blackburn, and he came off the pitch, took off his shirt, threw it down and walked down the tunnel, and the whole stadium chanted, "Ghali, you're a twat," at him.
Isn't there one as well?
That
you can't, you know, at the moment, when you say the stigma is worse than the reality, that the stigma is the narrative, and the way football is at the moment, the narrative is the reality. So you've got a lad who played in the youth system of the club that he's coming on against. He's being substituted off for perfectly intelligible reasons, but because there's got to be a story, that's what everyone focuses on. That then becomes the focus for him. That's then something he dwells on. Whereas if it weren't the case, Moyes would have probably taken him to one side and said, "Look, we need, you know, we were chasing the game. Yeah, he'd run around for an hour and not done very much. Fair's fair."
I think you're right. I also think you're right, Seb. Yeah, I think we used to treat our children more harshly. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sure Moyes did do that.
And now, now we're all namby pambies, aren't we? Now everyone's, what's it? It's Brexit Britain. It's the credit crunch.
The children
need to learn, don't they? They need to learn. And they never learn anymore. Now they just, you don't even have to go to school now. You do what you want. Oh, it's like, what are they going to do? Decriminalize murder? What are they going to do next? You know, kids used to be under our thumb. They used to be under our thumb. And now, what are they, just run around outside, you know, and there's just...
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Listen, next up, it's time for a Joe's Player Quote and Facts List. It's Joe's Quotes and Facts Database. There's the nice jingle. Listen, I'll be very honest with you. I have spent most of the week outside Parliament ranting about what the country used to be like, so I haven't actually added any names to the list. So we're still stuck here with Arsenal's goalkeepers and first-team defenders. And I'm sort of regretting getting carried away and doing almost all of them in the last episode, because now we're only left with, I believe,
Matt Macey.
No, I haven't got Matt Macey.
Matt Macy on my list. Goalkeeper in the first team squad.
You mean Matt Ryan?
No, I mean Matt Macy.
Matt Ryan now, but there is a Matt Macy. So you have
Matt Macy is not like I think he left
yeah. in January.
Yeah, thanks very much, Adonis. That's right. Ooh, I got backup from my producer. Oh. The two so-called football experts. What's happened to this country? He's not on their website. So if he's not on their website, listed in their first team, he doesn't exist. Yeah. So we've got, I think we did Matt Ryan. The only players we've got is we've got Kieran Tierney, and I believe we have Gabriel. Yeah. We haven't done either of those. So we can do both of those now, and then I'll have to do some new players for next time. The Gabriel fact, apparently neighbours of the family told his parents they should enrol him at an academy, having noticed his talents. You know, so it's a good job that they didn't live in a detached house. And the Gabriel's quote is, so many fans were sending me messages asking me to sign for Arsenal. So, you know, he did. And it's as easy as that. Kieran Tierney fact. Born on the Isle of Man.
Yeah. Was he really?
Yeah, he was. Born on an island. And it's important for you to know in the Kieran Tierney quote, which I've taken from his Twitter, that boys is spelt B-H-O-Y-S. So I'm going to say bohoys, okay? And that's just before we get started. The quote reads, and this is Kieran Tierney's quote from Twitter. There's something that the bohoys want you to know, and Seb was very confused about this before, weren't you, Seb? So I explained to you that Bahoys is an official nickname for Celtic supporters, didn't I?
Thank goodness you did that, yeah.
Thank goodness. We've had to re-record this bit because Seb didn't know that that was definitely meant that. Yeah. And so we re-recorded it just to, you know, and I'm just letting everybody know that it was Seb that didn't understand.
I talked myself into this big knot trying to cover my embarrassment.
You did, and it wasn't funny.
I wasted everybody's time. No.
Yeah, and producer Adonis has had to cut out a lot of what you said because what you said ended up actually not even just being not funny, but also quite offensive. So it's gone now, and I'm, you know, we'll be talking about this after the podcast, just as soon as I can find a mirror. But that is the end of the podcast now. We'll be back on Tuesday, game relevant on Tuesday, to be discussing whatever happens over the weekend. Hey, we're going to find out. Big games. But Leicester will be part of it, Leicester fans. I mean, not that there's a huge number of you listening, but, you know, we treasure the ones that are. And Alex, thanks to you.
Thanks, Joe.
And Seb, thanks to you.
Yeah, thanks, Joe. Sorry about the boys thing again.
No, that's fine. Really, stop reminding yourself that it happened. Thanks as always to producer Adonis for his hard work on this podcast, real hard work on this specific podcast. And we'll be back on Tuesday with more stuff for you of basically the same, but a little bit different. Au revoir.
The Athletic.